Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and our program is Fight the Empire. And our guest this morning is Michael W. Hudson. He's a staff writer at the Center for Public Integrity, formerly a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and an investigator for the Center for Responsible Lending. And he has a book out called The Monster: How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. It's all in one book, folks. Michael W. Hudson, well, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Why don't we start out? Let's see. You know, there is another Michael Hudson who's an economist who writes a lot about some of these issues, but you are not he.
I am not. As a matter of fact, Michael and I, this goes back a few years, have been confused with each other by lots of folks. There was a cover story that he did, very prescient, in early 2006 in Harper's about the coming real estate crash. I got all kinds of compliments for that, and of course I pushed aside the unworthy impulse to say thank you and said, well, no, it's actually not me, it's this economist. And then once I started writing for the Wall Street Journal, he started getting compliments.
Oh, really?
And it's continued. So we actually wrote a piece, our series of pieces in the Huffington Post. I think it's Michael Hudson Talks with Michael Hudson.
Oh, really?
Where we've done a basically a conversation in which we sort of talk about the identity confusion, but we also talk about our various perspectives on the financial crisis. And it's sort of interesting because, you know, Michael, being an economist, has you know, great sort of sense of the macro of what happened. And I'm, as a reporter, I'm more on the ground, really in the belly of the beast, talking to loan officers and mortgage underwriters and people like that. So it's sort of interesting to see we both in come to many of the same conclusions, but from different perspectives.
You ever actually meet him?
We had, when I was at the Journal, and we first sort of realized the confusion, we had lunch one day.
Uh-huh. Oh, great. Okay.
And so, and we've talked on the phone, as I said, decided once my book came out, there was a lot of confusion. It was clear from Amazon that people were buying both our books, you know, and it was pretty clear that people thought, oh, well, it was the... It was the, you know, Michael Hudson, the economist, has a new book out.
Boy,
as a matter of fact, there was one review, the customer review on Amazon, which said he really liked the book, but then said, actually, I bought this because I thought it was the other Michael Hudson. I'm glad I did.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, if you had the same publisher, you could do a twofer or something.
Exactly.
Well, you know, as long as we talk about macro points of view, this program is called Fight the Empire, and my macro point of view, which we don't really... is not really part of the discussion, but I just lay it out there, is that this American dream of home ownership, I think, began when the Americas were conquered by people who couldn't find a home in Europe. But that's a whole nother story,
right.
And we're going to talk about this, this big, huge mortgage scam. And why don't we start with all these shenanigans? Why don't you start with Orange County, California? That seems... that's kind of where the book starts, and they sort of go on to wider spheres of influence.
Right. You know, Orange County is an interesting place. I've visited there quite a lot. I know some nice folks there. It's a beautiful, you know, locale. But it's also a place that is the home to, some people said it's the boiler room capital of the country. Lots of, you know, boiler rooms selling precious metal, you know, fake precious metals, bogus investments. It also was really the epicenter, or one of the epicenters, of the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s. You probably heard of a guy named Charles Keating and Lincoln Savings and Loan.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
They were, Lincoln was based there. There were lots of other SNLs. So Orange County has this sort of interesting sort of history, sort of cowboy capitalism. It had for many years, it was Los Angeles's country cousin, I think, in around the time of World War II. Population was a couple hundred thousand, and it's grown exponentially till now. The population of the county is in the millions. So it's a place where sort of growth and doing whatever it takes. And there's not a tradition of old money, so people don't ask you how you're making your money necessarily, or look down on you if you're doing something, shall we say, a little inventive.
Yeah, maybe they don't want to know.
Right. And so I think, you know, what happened was is when the sort of cowboy capitalism, boiler room culture of Orange County, through the 70s subprime and the sort of the early sort of pioneers of subprime were based in Orange County, late 1980s, early 90s. When they got together with Wall Street, these sort of two financial cultures, Orange County and Wall Street, put them together. That really spelled disaster for our entire country created the global crisis.
Boy, well, later on we'll get to what Wall Street brought to this kind of marriage. But why do we, you know, you really describe a lot of the details of how these sort of sleazy mortgage companies operated. You know, like you started, well, like AmeriQuest Mortgage. That was just one of a number of them. But that's a really detailed stuff about the company.
Well, you think about it. You know, you go back a couple generations, and a loan officer was usually a local bank or savings and loan, sort of building and loan vice president. He sat in a corner office, and his job, and usually he sat in a corner office, and his job was to say no as often as he said yes. Ask the question, can and will this loan be repaid? Can the borrower afford the loan? And there were problems with that system. Minority borrowers were discriminated against. Women, especially single women, were discriminated against. But the basic concept, can and will this loan be repaid, is solid. You flash forward to 2004, 2005, and a loan officer was a 23-year-old kid who 6 months before had been working at Radio Shack. A company like AmeriQuest hires him and says, hey, come on, you know, hey kid, you know, you come work with us, you can make $100,000, $200,000 a year or more. And then, you know, we'll, and the loan officer was really just a telemarketer. It was, they gave him a headset, and they said, you make as many calls as possible. You need to make 200 calls in the next, you know, in the next 3 hours, or you're out the door, or you're fired. Do it, do it, do it. And the pressure was really incredible, but, of course, the rewards were incredible, too. And, you know, somebody who had been making $23,000 a year at Radio Shack was suddenly making $10,000 their first month, and their manager was saying, you know, you need to go out and buy the nicest car. You know, they wanted them to buy the best car, most expensive car they could get, so they would get locked into the car payments and locked into the lifestyle, have to come back the next month and sell more. And at AmeriQuest, you were only as good as your current month. If you set a record, you know, 1 month, then that became your floor. You had to beat that the next month. And there was this constant pressure to produce and constant pressure to do whatever it took, which meant lying to the borrowers, using bait-and-switch salesmanship, forging people's signatures on disclosure documents so they wouldn't understand, and basically just doing whatever you could to trap people into situations where they had to sign the documents, and often they didn't understand truly what they were getting because the loan products were so complex and really designed as time bombs. They look good at first blush and for an average consumer seemed to be a good deal, but down the road they would basically blow up in your face.
Mm. Well, it's like the paradigm of infinite growth, but one of these little tactics that stuck in my mind was like you get a stack of papers to sign, and you know, you tell the guy, well, you know, you insist on a fixed rate mortgage, and that may be on the top of the pile, but near the bottom of the pile is an adjustable rate mortgage. And then they just, when you sign them all, they just kind of dispose of the fixed rate paper.
It was easy to peel the fixed rate, the fake documents off the top and throw them in the trash. And you know, it's interesting. I've heard again, and I've read, and there have been comments to articles I've written and heard people say this thing, well, you know, you should never, you know, sign a document that you haven't read. And I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a defense against the folks who are taking advantage of people. You know, like, oh, you sign a document, it's tough luck. You know, that attitude is, I think, is pretty common out there. But, you know, I actually was at speaking to an audience in Virginia recently, and I said, you know, I know probably a lot of you people feel like, a lot of you in the audience feel that, you know, have that sense. But let me ask you a question. How many of you have credit cards? How many of you have read your credit card statements, which of course are you know, shorter, they're 4 or 5 pages, but how many of you read all that? How many of you know what your default, you know, if you're late on a payment, what your interest rate goes up to? How many of you know whether there's an arbitration clause which will prevent you from going to court if you have a dispute with your credit card company and force you into an arbitrator who's hired by the credit card company, and on and on and on. I mean, that, and that's the problem, is that And also with a lot of people, even it, you know, some people have low levels of literacy, but even smart people can get fooled by good salesmen because they, you know, they're always thinking ahead. They're doing dozens, hundreds, thousands of loans. You're doing one every year or 10 or 5 years or 10 years. And so to think that that the, you know, consumers can defend themselves against slick salesmanship and outright fraud without help is, I think, is a little bit foolish.
Well, you'd have to, you know, take hours to read all those documents anyway, and then you sort of have to have some kind of legal training to understand a lot of that stuff.
Right, and you know, lots of times there were lawyers there at, in some states it's required that there be a closing attorney, so there were lawyers there at the closing. But of course, in many cases, the borrowers would think, "Oh, well, there's a lawyer there; he's looking out for my interests." But really, they weren't. They were being paid by the home seller or by the you know, the home building company that it, you know, was selling, you know, the house and peddling the loan, or by the mortgage company. So, people often had no advocates, no one on their side when it came to sitting down and closing the loan.
Well, it's like these guys who are working for these companies, you know, they're under constant pressure, you know. Oh, and they're kind of stoked up on Red Bull and cocaine. You go into that, and you had a thing about, they have parties with strippers, and they what they call power hours. Tell us a little bit about that kind of stuff.
Right. You know, as one of the guys I spent a lot of time interviewing told me, he said, you know, it was just like college, but with money and power. You know, it was that same. It was very much like a think of the most out of control frat house mm-hmm. party you can imagine, the Animal House kind of atmosphere. And now think of what they're doing while they're partying is they're selling people loans, which you know, on their homes, which with the vast majority of American families are the most important investments, the biggest and most important investments they have, and you know, people, it was sort of do whatever it takes, say whatever it takes, and have a good time doing it, and they would go out and you know, the manager would spend, you know, $1,000, $2,000 taking everyone in the branch out, you know, for steaks and Dom Perignon and, you know, going to nightclubs around town and all that kind of thing. And so it could be very, I think it could be very seductive, and many of the former loan officers and branch managers and folks like that I talked to definitely got seduced into this lifestyle. And you know, as long as you were on the team, as long as you were doing what it took, it was great. But of course, if you raised one question, if you said, hey, I'm feeling uncomfortable about this loan, you know, I think the rate is too high. The people actually have good credit. They're not even subprime customers. I think we're taking advantage. I think we need to rewrite this loan. And it would be like, you know, you're out the door, you know, mm-hmm. do it, or it's your, you know, it's your butt.
Okay. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the other thing I want to mention is that AmeriQuest, they actually, I don't know if folks have seen that, the movie, The Boiler Room, with Giovanni Ribisi and Ben Affleck, which is about a, you know, boiler room operation that's selling bogus stock investments. AmeriQuest actually, in many branches, used that as a training tape. They would show that to people to kind of teach them how to sell and how to talk to people on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Michael W. Hudson, who has written a book called The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. So let's get into the Wall Street connection. Now, how did Wall Street get into all this?
Right, you know, it's this idea of securitization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually what would happen was, you know, the loan would be made by a small lender or arranged by a mortgage broker. Then the small lender would sell the loan up the line to a bigger lender, which would then sell the loan up to a Wall Street firm, which would then offload the loan into a pool of similar mortgages and create what's called a mortgage-backed securities deal. And then they would sell securities and bonds backed by the income stream from the loans in the pool to investors all over the world. And then, of course, those investors would take those bonds and then put them into new investment vehicles, which would then sell new bonds. And it was this sort of Ponzi scheme of sort of shuffling the loans around and moving them around and repackaging them. Wall Street first got, you know, started getting involved in a small way in the late 80s, early 90s, but it was really the mid 90s when Wall Street kind of realized, hey, this is, you know, this is going to be a big business. This is something we can make lots and lots of money. Lehman Brothers sent a vice president out to Orange County in 1995 to look at a company called First Alliance Mortgage. He came back and wrote this really kind of scathing memo that described First Alliance as a financial sweatshop that specialized in high-pressure sales for people who are in a weak state, a place where you checked your ethics at the door. This was a company that would had an amazing sales pitch that would trap people into paying as much as $20,000 up front on a $100,000 loan. In other words, they were paying 20 points. But none of this seemed to bother Lehman too much. They actually said, hey, that's a great idea. We should work with them. So over the next few years, it helped First Alliance raise hundreds of millions of dollars to bankroll its lending and even continued bankrolling First Alliance even after other Wall Street banks decided they didn't want anything to do with the company.
Okay, go ahead.
No. So anyway, the point of this story is that, you know, this idea that, like, we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
There were many warnings for Wall Street banks that these loans were questionable, predatory, fraudulent, but they were ignored.
Well, I guess Lehman had a reputation of being kind of an honest corporation. You know, they had a history and everything. But say you start out with I've got a mortgage. Now, what happens? Now, I sort of wondering about this process. They talk about slicing and dicing, and how do they do that? What are they? I have a mortgage, and somehow they take my mortgage and maybe 1,000 others, and they put them all together into some kind of security. But what is a slicing and dicing? Do they actually take my mortgage into separate pieces, or is it?
Well. Yeah, they don't actually slice and dice, but mm-hmm. you know, because all the money is pooled together, so you've got 1,000 mortgages, and let's just say there's, you know, the monthly mortgage payment is $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do the math in my head. What's 1,000 times 1,000? Anyway,
at a million?
Maybe 100, maybe 10 million.
Whatever it is.
Let's
okay.
Zero. So let's say it's six zeros.
Mm-hmm. That's a million.
That's a million.
Yeah.
So that's $1 million coming
mm-hmm.
in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So investors are, you know, who have bought bonds, basically, who have invested in the pool. Maybe you've got 50 investors, so they split the money coming in 50 ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't really own. So in a sense, everyone owns a fraction of your mortgage.
Right, okay.
But no individual necessarily owns the whole mortgage. No individual investor, anyway. I mean, it's very complicated. They call these pools, they call them SIVs, which sounds like a social disease, but it's special investment vehicles, which were actually the same sort of accounting shells that were used by Enron during its, you know, sort of fraud spree.
So then this exploded. I mean, it just kind of all, there was so much money here, and it kind of, it was like a bubble, and then it burst.
Right. And so much of it was based on smoke and mirrors, really sort mm-hmm. of accounting, ledger domain, a bait and switch salesmanship, and you know, just old-fashioned people lying to other people. And all the way up the line, and again, you know, there's this a lot of books have sort of portrayed the what happened as, well, it was inappropriate risk taking by the, you know, by Wall Street. It was, you know, they didn't know what they were getting into. You know, the CEOs were detached, and they weren't, you know, they weren't on it enough, and that's why they got in trouble. But, you know, the reality is, I'll use a legal term here, they knew or should have known. If you're running a company, you need, and you're making multi-billion-dollar investments, you should know, not personally, you don't have to crack open the loan files, but you hire people, you have people working for you who are cracking open loan files, who are checking spreadsheets for the data, for the characteristics of the loans, who are checking out the companies that you're buying loans from, looking at lawsuits, looking at complaints to state regulators, that kind of thing. And there were people in the system who were doing that, but again and again, and I've talked to many of them, and other journalists have talked to them, who say, you know, we did our jobs. We underwrote the loans, or we were a fraud investigator. We found fraud. We tried to kick out the bad loans, and we were told, you know, shut up and do your job. And by do your job, that means just pushing the loans through. And so I talked to lots of people who were in-house fraud investigators in the industry, and when they found fraud, one of several things happened. They were ignored. They were marginalized. They were demoted. They were fired, or some combination of the above.
One of the details that really struck me was, like, if you're the manager of one of these offices and you're not meeting, if you meet your quota, you know, you get all kinds of praise and everything else. If you don't, you get a rubber dog poop. And you have to keep it on your desk for the month. You know?
Right.
Talk about humiliation.
Exactly. There was a lot of humiliation. There was a lot of, you know, one story at AmeriQuest, there was a sort of a low-level functionary who had accidentally wrote up the paperwork for a loan on a Saturday, which they weren't supposed to do. They were supposed to only do it during a weekday. And so her manager took her and a couple other basically clerks who had done the same mistake and forced them to go ride in the manager's car to a car wash and wash the car.
Oh my.
And then they took a picture of all the three, you know, employees mm-hmm. who had made the mistake standing in front of the car with their heads bowed. Then they blew up the photo, you know, giant, almost life size, and hung it in a corridor where everyone could see, and said, "Don't let this happen to you."
Yeah, boy.
So, and, you know, that's a small thing, but it's the kind of attitude. There was also at one AmeriQuest branch in California, according to a lawsuit, there was a manager who was a military veteran who claimed that he had special dispensation from HR to impose any kind of physical punishment he wanted on his employees, and so one of his things is you can't sit down. You have to stand at your desk until you book a loan, and that might take hours. You know, you might be standing up for 3 hours. Also, the sales contest losers would have to do push-ups. He'd make them wear wigs, and it was just, you know, it was that kind of atmosphere. A little bit like going back to the fraternity idea, a little bit like a fraternity hazing.
Well, the impression I get is that these Wall Street investors, they had a lot of pressure behind them. They were sitting on all this kind of hot money that had to go someplace. And so that's a big frantic thing. You know, you have money and people want to invest it somewhere that's safe and profitable.
Right. AmeriQuest, when it was, I broke a story in early 2005 with Scott Record at LA Times about the sort of boiler room operations at AmeriQuest. Soon thereafter, it was revealed that several dozen state authorities were around the country were investigating AmeriQuest, and then AmeriQuest put out amid this sort of storm of bad publicity, AmeriQuest put out a new securities deal. And according to the trade press, it was several times oversubscribed. In other words, there were many times more investors who wanted to buy pieces of the pool than there were actually securities to buy. So there was this sort of frantic hunger for these kinds of investments. Part of it was because the rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, would give these pools AAA ratings, which meant that the investments, backed by the pools of loans, were the safest investments you could buy. So think about that. You're taking highly risky loans, people who supposedly have bad credit, and you're pooling them together, and somehow you figure out a way through accounting wizardry to turn them into incredibly safe investments. But they're safe, but they have much higher rates of return than other AAA rated investments. And so investors were worried about low rates they could get on treasuries and other sort of assets, and you know, was this, and they fooled themselves into thinking we can have the best of both worlds. We can have safe investments that are, that we know are going to be paid off, that are always going to pay. They're not going to default. We're going to get our money back that we put in it back, and we're going to get incredible returns. You know, again, I think it was a case of people either knew that there was something hinky going on, or they should have known. They should have had enough common sense to look at this and say, how can you have a AAA rated investment that's returning this amount of monthly interest?
And then when people started defaulting, the whole thing fell apart. I think we have about a minute left, and so I'd like to ask one last question. Is you know, now there's this possibility that these foreclosures may not they may not be able to foreclose because no one can prove that who owns what property. What do you think will happen with that?
It's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I suspect that my guess is that the Obama administration, the federal government, will come in and try to create some sort of system or compromise. You know, the question is, as with some of the other programs they've had, is it going to be primarily to benefit the banks, the mortgage industry, or is it going to benefit everyone? Is it going to benefit borrowers, homeowners who are struggling to get by, who really, with just a little help, if they get their mortgages cut, you know, their monthly payments cut by 10% or 20%, they could actually struggle by and stay in their homes and keep paying, and you know, and investors would eventually get their money back.
You think they'd be better off that way? They get more money than if they foreclose and had to sell it.
Right, but unfortunately, the big banks that are doing the foreclosing don't necessarily, because of this securitization process where the loans have been sold off around the world, they don't necessarily own the loans. All they're doing is just, you know, acting as functionaries, collecting on the loans, and they don't make a lot of money if they're collecting on-time payments, but they make a lot of money out of late fees and attorney's fees and foreclosure fees, and they make money often when the loans go into foreclosure. So they're incentivized to
people
into foreclosure.
I think we're going to have to end it there. This has been really fascinating. We've been talking with Michael W. Hudson, author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.